KIRP Radio! When you're looking for real truth, real talk radio, make sure you log on to KIRPRadioshow.com. Sunday nights live, 8 p.m. with your host.
Rocco P. Yes, it is the last Sunday night of the month. And Pudgy Miller lets me host this show. Thank you, Pudgy. Tonight I'm going to be discussing the downing of that Russian jet in Syria. Really came down in Syria, though Turkey had said violated Turkey's airspace. There's so much involved in this story. There's so much involved with what's going on with ISIS in Iraq and especially Syria. Initially, I was thinking about talking about the refugee crisis, and this is all obviously tied together, but I'm going to focus on that downing of that Russian jet because the implications of that as the U.S. goes forward, really, because this thing called NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, we'll talk a little bit about NATO down the road in the program, but what had happened, what were the bare facts? What happened? What were we told? What were we not told? On Tuesday, this past Tuesday, November 24th, a Russian jet, specifically an Su-24 attack aircraft, was shot down by Turkey. Turkey had said, had gone to great lengths to say the Russian jet had violated their airspace. Russia had said that's not the case. And I'll read a quote in a moment by Vladimir Putin himself, the president of Russia. Okay, so there's two conflicting stories. What is my perspective of what happened? In all probability, the Russian jet did not violate Turkish airspace. I don't believe that happened in all probability. But let's say it did. Let's say the Russian jet did violate Turkey's airspace. What would be involved in that, right? Think about what is being presented to the world, not just the U.S. Public, but to the world about what's going on now in Syria. Okay, in Syria. There is a civil war. Okay, ISIS is really beyond a terrorist force. It's a non-state actor. It's really acting as an army, literally. Okay, and we could talk about how ISIS has gotten all their military equipment, how ISIS has been funded. We'll talk a little bit about that as far as the oil money. But the basics of the conflict is that you have this rogue, so-called rogue army of ISIS, Islamic States of Iraq and Syria. People say ISIL or Islamic State. And they're clearly trying to depose the president of Syria, President Assad. The U.S. has taken a position that Assad has to go with really no explanation. And that's the first thing I'll get to in a moment as far as the humanitarian angle. The U.S. has tried to claim that for humanitarian reasons, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria has to go. At the same time, the U.S. has said that they're opposed to ISIS. Now, think about that. If the U.S. has two objectives as far as Syria is concerned, one is that they believe Assad should go, and the other is to get rid of ISIS. You'd have to say, okay, what is the larger objective if there's two? They certainly haven't treated them with the same level of importance. In other words, the U.S. has not made a serious effort to remove ISIS from the area. I think that's obvious. I don't think anyone at this point could debate that. If in fact the U.S. had made a serious effort to attack ISIS in Iraq and especially in Syria, be no need for Russia to have entered the theater. In other words, Russia entered the conflict militarily because of the devastation that ISIS had caused to Syria. Again, once I do have to stress, we're not talking about just a bunch of guys, you know, just somehow got a few machine guns and mounted this force. Now, we're talking about a highly organized military effort, literally. We're talking about an army. And that again, opens up the questions as far as how did ISIS get the money? How did they get the logistics? How did they get the military equipment? How did they get the training to do this? Because to fight an actual war in Syria, and make no mistake about it, I mean, this is a civil war involving Syria. In order to do that, people, nations, there's people involved that are actively helping ISIS, training them, funding them. So, but think about it. If let's say the Russian jet did, for you know, just to present the argument, if the Russian jet did violate Turkish airspace, why would Turkey shoot it down? If, and this is the big if in fact Turkey, as a NATO member, as a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, okay, the United States has said they're opposed to ISIS. If that occurred, when you know full well that Russia is there to fight ISIS, why would it even be an issue? See, this is why the narrative is really falling apart, that the U.S. has, that the U.S. again says Assad has to go based upon this idea of humanitarian reason. Okay, so the U.S. claims they don't like the way Assad has treated his people. Right? So the U.S. says, all right, there's a moral reason that Assad should step down. Okay. You know, you throw the Constitution out the door at this point. Yeah, this is a sovereign nation. The U.S. has no legal right to intervene. Boom, then it would be over. But people, you know, President Obama is an oath breaker. He doesn't respect his oath of office. The vast majority of people in the U.S. Senate don't respect their oath of office. The vast majority of people in the U.S. House of Representatives don't respect their oath of office. So we have these illegal wars that have gone on and on and on since the end of World War II. The last time war was legally declared, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, was against Romania as part of World War II. And of course, there were other nations involved, but that was the last legal war. Every war since then has been illegal. And the precedent was started after World War II. The U.S. got involved in a war in Korea based upon a United Nations mandate. That was an extremely dangerous precedent that the U.S. still follows to today. We're also going to talk about that later. So we have this Russian jet that goes down over Syria, even though Turkey said it violated their airspace. So if you did want to believe Turkey's version of it, if you wanted to believe their story, then you say, okay, it went down Syria, but it was shot down when it was over a Turkish airspace. The Washington Post ran a piece on the same day, November 24th, and you see the terrible time they're having trying to convince the readers about what happened when they're trying to interpret this event. I'll read it. This is a quote from the Washington Post piece on November 24th. Quote, "The downing," meaning the downing of the Russian jet, "the downing brings renewed attention to a scenario feared for months by the Pentagon and its partners, a potential conflict arising from overlapping air missions over Syria, with Russia backing the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and a U.S.-led coalition conducting airstrikes against the Islamic State." So they're saying, they use this phrase, overlapping missions. Okay. So what is really, why is there a conflict if the missions are overlapping? The reality is the mission should be the same. It goes back to where I said before. The U.S. claims, and I think now the world knows, most people objectively know, it's just not true. The U.S. claims that they want to eliminate ISIS. And they don't. They don't. They want to topple Assad. And that's created the whole false narrative. You know, John McCain, who's been lying since, you know, the inset, you know, before he became U.S. Senator. John McCain, who's made his career being a liar, has talked about the Free Syrian Army. And they created this this illusion, complete fabrication, that there's these moderate Syrian opposition to President Assad. And again, that begs the question that why does Assad have to go? And even if he was a horrific leader, and that remains to be seen in my opinion, okay, you look at the state of Syria, okay, very similar to Iraq before the U.S. invasion, very similar. You have a secular Muslim state. In other words, you don't have a religious state. It's not like the alleged ally of the United States, Saudi Arabia, who regularly beheads people. Okay, the Sharia law isn't in place in Syria. Just like occurred in Iraq, you had a secular Muslim state where you had a fairly high degree of freedom of religion. They respect religious minorities. Christians were protected in Iraq. Christians are protected in Syria. Yet the U.S. maintains Assad has to go. And that's what this really comes down to. There aren't overlapping missions. Okay, because when the Washington Post says Russia backing the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and the U.S.-led coalition conducting airstrikes against the Islamic State, well, surprise, surprise, who is opposing Assad? ISIS. ISIS is opposing Assad. So if the missions were real, in other words, if the United States was seriously committed to getting rid of ISIS, and they're obviously not, then there's no conflict. There's no conflict whatsoever. But the U.S. isn't, and now people are seeing that, you know, this is a complete fabrication. It's total fiction what the U.S. public has been told about this. Once again, to make it very simple, the U.S. says they're opposing ISIS. ISIS wants to topple Assad. The U.S. says Assad has to go. What's the U.S. What is the real objective of the United States militarily? It's to topple Assad. Okay. And what's the pattern been? We take the so-called humanitarian angle. Okay. Once again, I want to stress there's absolutely no constitutional authority for the U.S. military to be involved in this conflict. Game over. There's none. Period. There's none. If the U.S. wanted to follow the Constitution in this, you could use Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, and you could do that by issuing a letter of marque or reprisal. At this point, though, let's face it, Russia has demonstrated that they're determined to significantly fight ISIS. So why would the U.S., if the goal really is to get rid of ISIS, the U.S. doesn't really have to be involved. Not military. They could give some logistical support to Russia. They could help Russia in those ways without being involved. But Russia's demonstrated they're willing to do the airstrikes that the U.S. has said they want to do, but never really did. Okay. And when I make a statement like that, when I said, U.S., Russia's made airstrikes, the U.S. has said that, they want to do. Okay, here's a gem. Here's a gem. This came out after this actually came out well before the Russian jet was downed. But then it was brought to my attention yet again after a Russian jet was shot down by Turkey. Okay, even the National Review admits this. I'll quote a piece that from a National Review this week. After 15 months of airstrikes against ISIS, America finally managed to bomb 116 trucks that smuggle—I like the word smuggle—oil out of ISIS territory, generating some $1.2 million in clandestine cash daily. Okay. That figure there, that $1.2 million, what they say in clandestine cash, I don't think it's that clandestine. we're talking about $40 million a month or $500 million a year. And guess what? This oil that ISIS is getting from Iraq, they can't sell it in Iraq. It goes on trucks. Okay, it's a highly organized operation, like I said before, with ISIS. Okay, this is a highly organized operation. Gets on trucks. And where does it go to before they sell it? It goes to Turkey, and then they sell it to other places. So when you look at what's going on now, the U.S. is losing control of the narrative because people are realizing this story had broke again. It had been out there, but it got more attention after the Russian jet was downed. That begs the question: why was the U.S. for 15 months when they knew exactly what was going on? ISIS is being funded not exclusively but to a large degree, through oil they're stealing through Iraq. So if this whole idea, if this airstrike wasn't just a complete and preposterous and colossal lie, the U.S. could have easily bombed those trucks in Iraq at any time. They know where they're going. They think about the sophistication of satellite images, of photos. And they know exactly. They knew exactly what was going on. Okay. Now, to quote the National Review again, that some buys plenty of knives for beheadings, Kalashnikovs for mass shootings, and plastique for suicide vests. France now leads the war on terror in the wake of ISIS' November 13th massacre in Paris. Obama must have reckoned that with France bombing from in front, he might as well bomb from behind. Okay, so it takes the U.S. 15 months to stop this, and they really didn't. That they got involved. It took Russia. I didn't pull up the statistic, the numbers right in front of me, but Russia devastated. I don't know how many of those tankers and the trucks within a week. I don't know, 100 sorties. So the U.S. is losing the narrative here. In other words, they're losing not just the story, they're losing the way people interpret this, because people are seeing it's illogical. It's not that Obama's weak. Obama has no problem killing people. Okay, let's face that. He expanded the illegal drone strikes against, and most of those kill innocent civilians. So Obama has no problem. The Obama administration has no problem killing people. You can make a real good argument that they enjoy killing innocent civilians. So there's no problem. There's no objection to Obama using military power. The real truth in this is that the U.S. is not and has not been committed to attacking ISIS. And I would suggest, okay, that's to a large degree, that ISIS is the creation of Western intelligence. Okay, that's a bigger point. I'm not going to go there right now. That's a real simple explanation for why the U.S. is not dealing with ISIS. Now, I want to get back to this humanitarian angle here. The humanitarian angle. Okay. So even some U.S. politicians have questioned openly why Assad has to go. And as I've already said now, numerous times, there's no base in the Constitution to just oppose a leader because the U.S. says they don't like him or he's treating their people wrong. And when you use this humanitarian argument, again, the legal argument, if you follow the Constitution, it's not there. When you look at the humanitarian argument, it completely explodes. It's another colossal, horrific lie. In Iraq, after the U.S. invaded, about 25% of the Iraqi population became refugees. We don't know how many civilians were killed after the invasion because the U.S. military, I think it's an embarrassment, they don't record those numbers. So in spite of all the money that's at the disposal of the U.S. military, they really don't like to count civilian casualties. And I think we know why. They do not like to count civilian casualties because that would be a terrible embarrassment to them. So we have that going on. We had that going on in Iraq, right? In Libya, very similar situation. You had Muammar Gaddafi. Okay, Gaddafi had done things, had been involved in terrorism years past. But then the U.S. decided, apart from any congressional declaration of war again, and even apart from a token congressional resolution or a token funding of that, President Obama sends a letter to then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid saying, I just want to let you know I'm bombing Libya. Okay, what's happened since that? Okay. The U.S. again tried to use the humanitarian argument to say Muammar Gaddafi has to go. The U.S. goes in, bombs Libya, helps these radical jihadis gain power. And now life in Libya, you could say that regime is maybe not 1,000 times worse, maybe 100 times worse than wherever Gaddafi was. And then the people suffer again. So you look at what's happened in Iraq, and one estimate, a British polling organization at one point in the Iraq war, took some numbers, and they estimated, okay, how many Iraqi civilians have died? And then the low number they came up with was 600,000. That was a low number. Okay. So when you look in terms of of, again, there's no constitutional basis for these wars. Then you look at the humanitarian angle. It's an illusion. I mean, that's a nice way to say it. It's a colossal lie. It's a colossal lie. The vast majority of Iraqis, vast majority want the Saddam to go, but the vast majority had no desire for the U.S. to be there. And the U.S., I mean, the infrastructure was devastated in Iraq. Life has never been the same. Another way to look at this, again, is in terms of liberties. As I said before, Iraq was a secular Muslim state. There was respect for religious minorities, including Christians. After the U.S. invaded, that all went away, and the U.S. helped transform Iraq into an Islamic republic. Okay. So when you hear some of this stuff, you might say, well, that makes no sense. Well, it does if you understand the goal is to destabilize the Middle East. It's not to build it up. To the humanitarian argument, I think, when I first heard this, I couldn't believe it. And that was that under sanctions before the Iraq war, okay, I'm saying even the first one, after Iraq invaded Kuwait, before the first Iraq war, there were sanctions against Iraq. They occurred under President Bill Clinton. And those sanctions resulted in the deaths of 1.5 million Iraqi civilians. So when you try and use the so-called moral high ground or say, you know, the U.S. has this moral authority or obligation to be involved, it makes absolutely no sense as far as what has occurred.
Real gon' recognize, real gon' recognize, real gon' recognize, real, real phony gon' recognize, still, I reckon I will.
Like we always do with this time, I go for mine, I get to shine, now throw your hands up in the sky. I go for mine, I get to shine, now throw your hands up in the sky.
I'm a kid on the TV, mama, I'ma put this down.
Listening to the KRP radio show last Sundays with Rocco P, talking about this humanitarian reason, the humanitarian explanation for the U.S. to be involved in these foreign wars. Historically, sanctions have been considered an act of war. Okay? During, again, as I mentioned, during the Clinton administration, 1.5 million Iraqis, including, that included 500,000 children, died due to hunger because of sanctions the U.S. put in. So when you understand this, you start to realize, apart from having no basis in the highest law of the land, the Constitution, there is no moral basis for these policies. There's none whatsoever. There's none whatsoever. I'm going to play a clip from Madeleine Albright when she was on 60 Minutes, and that question was asked about, you know, about the policy.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Yeah, that was from 1996. That was from 1996 when Madeleine Albright was on 60 Minutes. Now, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson was on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman back in 2005, and Amy Goodman also raised that issue.
We are joined right now in the Capitol building where we're broadcasting from by New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. He is a seven-term Congress member, served in the House of Representatives for seven terms. He was the Energy Secretary under Bill Clinton, as well as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, now Governor of New Mexico. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. But many say that although President Bush led this invasion, that President Clinton laid the groundwork with the sanctions and with the previous bombing of Iraq. You were President Clinton's U.S.
Right.
ambassador to the United Nations.
The sanctions were the correct policy.
Right. The sanctions, for example, the sanctions led to the deaths of more than 500,000 children, not to mention 1 million Iraqis.
I stand behind the sanctions. I believe that they successfully contained Saddam Hussein. I believe that the sanctions were an instrument of our policy.
To ask a question that was asked of U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Madeleine Albright, do you think the price was worth it, 500,000 children dead?
Well, I believe our policy was correct, yes.
So, there you have it. You had someone who worked for the Clinton administration, Bill Richardson, former governor of New Mexico, at the time of the interview in 2005, confirms what Madeleine Albright said, the policy was worth it. It was worth it due to these policy objectives, whatever it was, to kill 1.5 million Iraqis, including 500,000 children. So, again, when people, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, and if you listen to me, you know, I mean, I'm quoting these guys, but I'm not just going after the Democrats. This is far bigger than Obama, because obviously the Republicans control Congress and they could stop it and they don't want to. When people, regardless of their background, try to say that, well, there's what the U.S. has done in the Middle East, it's moral, or if they say this has helped the people, they're wrong. I mean, they're just terribly misinformed. And of course the people in Washington know they're liars, but the people we're talking to, we're rubbing shoulders with, by and large, they don't. They're believing the sound bites, they're believing what they get in 5-10 minutes that they hear on CNN or Fox News or elsewhere. That's what they believe. Gonna come up to a break now. We're gonna talk more about this bigger issue as far as the policy in the US, US policy in the Middle East, and why we're seeing what's going on.
How many more innocent people?
How many more?
How many more?
What has been the number one cause of unnatural death in history?
Democide, or death by government, has killed 290 million people on record.
Look it up. Go look it up.
In the 20th century, government murdered 4 times as many people as were killed in all the international and domestic wars combined.
USSR. 61,911,000 people killed.
Hitler's Germany, nearly 21 million people killed.
Japan's imperialism, nearly 6 million people killed.
Western colonization killed over 50 million people.
Pol Pot's Cambodia, funded by the U.S. government, 2 million people killed.
China's Communist Party, as many as 76 million people killed between 1949 and 1987.
And the list goes on and on.
Demand to know why the Department of Homeland Security bought more than 1.6 billion hollow point bullets.
How many more people does government have to kill?
Enough. Enough.
Demand an end to citizen disarmament.
As an American.
As an American citizen.
As a patriot.
For your children.
Enough of the people laying down and letting government kill them en masse after disarming them, as they've done throughout history over and over again.
Now is the time.
It's time.
It's time to realize that when the government takes your guns, people die.
It's time to realize the biggest threat to you and your family is government.
It's time to recognize government is the greatest killer of all time.
Demand they show you the word hunting in the Second Amendment.
Demand our politicians uphold the Constitution and Bill of Rights as they swore to when they took office.
It's time for our leaders to read the Constitution.
It's time for our leaders to obey the Constitution.
The Constitution.
The Constitution.
Because a well-regulated militia with 10-round magazines wouldn't last very long.
So now you know the most dangerous thing to you and your family in the world is government.
Because mass murderers agree, gun control works.
You're You're listening to the KRP radio show, Last Sundays with Rock OP. I'm talking about U.S. policy in the Middle East in light of the downing of this Russian jet by Turkey. I read a piece by Pepe Escobar. Pepe Escobar is an independent journalist. He's from Brazil. He used to work for, The Asian Times. He does some work for RT, so he's not just owned by the Russians hardly. He is independent, but he does some work for RT. But he pointed out, he gave me some information that was not reported widely at all in the U.S. media, and that's that Russian President Vladimir Putin had a press conference with the President, President Hollande of France, after this occurred. And this is what Putin said. And again, there was numerous statements that, you know, Turkey could prove that this Russian jet violated their airspace. This is what Putin himself said. Quote, "We told our U.S. partners in advance where, when, at what altitudes our pilots were going to operate. The U.S.-led coalition, which includes Turkey, was aware of the time and place where our planes would operate. And this is exactly where and when we were attacked. Why did we share this information with the Americans? Either they don't control their allies, or they just pass this information left and right without realizing what the consequences of such actions might be. We will have to have a serious talk with our U.S. partners." So from, there's really two completely different stories being told here, two explanations. Turkey says Russia violated their airspace. Russia says they did everything they can to tell the U.S. coalition, which really isn't a coalition, it's really NATO front group, really. These NATO groups, NATO nations are acting at the behest of the U.S. He said he told them outright exactly what was going on, and they still shot him down. Now, I talked about the moral argument, the humanitarian argument, and it's been a colossal lie. It was a lie in Iraq, and the results have been horrifically bad for the people of Iraq and U.S. foreign policy as Iraq is less stable. It's been horrifically bad in Afghanistan, and incidentally, the U.S. forces are still in Afghanistan since after 9/11. Yes, they're still there. It's been horrifically bad in Libya, and if the Russians aren't successful in destroying ISIS, certainly the U.S. really doesn't want to get rid of ISIS, then it's going to be horrifically bad if President Assad is deposed. When you share some of this information with people, a lot of people will see, okay, well, you know, what you're saying is true. And then they ask a really good question. That's, you know, why? Why? Some people will attempt to interpret U.S. policy by just saying people are stupid, you know, left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And I think that's erroneous. I think that's completely false because we see a very clear direction in U.S. foreign policy. Many people have said Obama's first term was Bush's third term. And you could basically make a real, real strong argument with that, even if you're going to say something domestically, something like Obamacare. Well, what greased the skid, so to speak? What prepared the way for Obamacare? It was Medicare, the expansion of Medicare, including drugs and Medicare, which that was a large expansion of government health care until Obamacare. That occurred under the Republican George W. Bush. Foreign policy, again, Obama continued this illegal war on terror. You can't declare war on a concept. If you define terrorism as a concept, you can't declare war on a tactic, if you define terrorism as a tactic. So that is a very good question. People say, okay, well, you give me these facts. Okay, you've convinced me now. Okay, what the U.S. is doing isn't moral. It's not humanitarian. It's not helping the people. And it also doesn't make the U.S. more safe. There was a clip. I didn't pull it up tonight. But General Petraeus, when he was in charge of the forces in Iraq, he went before the Senate. And there was actually a real question at the time asked by by a senator from Virginia. And that question was, is the U.S. more safe after being involved in the Iraq war? And Petraeus at first refused to answer that question. And then the senator pressed him again. And Petraeus an- Petraeus' answer was honest. He said, I really don't know. So you think about the cost in the terms of dollars. You think about the cost in terms of U.S. lives, not just U.S. lives lost, but all the servicemen, all those who've been injured. And if it's about keeping the U.S. safe, and then when a general can't even say, in this case, Petraeus, he doesn't know, what's the point? But they're not just stupid, okay? They're not just, some people pass it off as that, and yeah, that they ignore the fact that the U.S. foreign policy is very consistent between the Democrats and Republicans. And that's why, for example, anyone running third party, they'll never let them sit in a presidential debate. And the debate commission, I may have mentioned this before on the show, the presidential debate commission is controlled by ex-members of the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee. So they just want to give you that false choice. They want to give you, they create the illusion of choice. They give us false choices. They give us the illusion of choice. So they keep out any other voices. So then they debate minor points when it's basically the same. And you see that now. You see that now again with this horrific attack upon Assad and the U.S. feigning pose ISIS. Yet the real objective is to topple Assad. General Wesley Clark was a NATO general, and he had said this, I believe, back in 2007. He was in the Pentagon. Okay, and you could say, do I trust Wesley Clark? No, obviously I don't know him personally, but he's an interesting character. I think, like most people at his level, he had tried to run for president. He was independent, and then he declared as a Democrat. But Wesley Clark talked about how there was a plan that was revealed to him. And again, he made the statement in 2007. He said this was revealed to him, I believe, after 9/11, about the U.S. wanting to destabilize the Middle East and basically topple a certain number of countries. And so this is what Wesley Clark said.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq? Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you, but there was definitely, there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region. About 10 days ahead.
All right, Wesley Clark, and that really confirms a document. You could do a start page search, startpage.com. You could use startpage.com. You could use duckduckgo.com. I don't use the other guy. Don't use the big player. I won't say their name. And you can search the Project for a New American Century, Project for a New American Century, they wrote a white paper called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And in that, among other things, they said they did want to reshape the Middle East, but barring a new Pearl Harbor type event, the U.S. public wouldn't be behind it. And then 9/11 occurred. So we talked about the oil, how the U.S. didn't bomb that oil. I had mentioned NATO. Okay, NATO. When the situation with Turkey is even more serious because of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO was started in 1949, and that was a few years after the UN was started. UN was started in 1945 after World War II. The League of Nations had failed dramatically. It was done away with. You had World War I. Right after World War II, they tried again, gave it a new name, Rockefeller Money. You have that nice real estate in Midtown Manhattan that was donated, so to speak, by the Rockefeller family for the United Nations, and that's because the Rockefeller families, they're just terribly committed to humanitarian causes. No, they are committed to globalism. They're committed to one world government. You go back to NATO, and what's happened is you have, I'm going to read Article 5 of North Atlantic Treaty. And then from that NATO, you have members of North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The premise, allegedly, for NATO, again, it was tied to the UN, but still, the premise is that as you had the Soviet Union post-World War II, you needed an alliance in Europe to counter them. So, yeah, that would sound reasonable. Okay, that would sound reasonable. Without going in another direction, let me just read Article 5 from North Atlantic Treaty. This goes back to April 4th, 1949. Quote, the parties agree that an armed attack against one or more of them in Europe or North America shall be considered an armed attack against them all, and consequently they agree that if such an armed attack occurs, each of them, in exercise of the right of individual or collective self-defense, recognized by Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, will assist the party or parties so attacked by taking forthwith, individually and in concert with the other parties, such actions as it deems necessary, including the use of armed force, to restore and maintain the security of the North Atlantic area. Any such armed attack and all measures taken as a result thereof shall immediately be reported to the Security Council, meaning the UN Security Council. Such measures shall be terminated when the Security Council has taken the measures necessary to restore and maintain international peace and security. So you have NATO, 1949, basically carving out this agreement to a large degree based upon the authority of the UN. So you see how these agreements subvert the individual sovereignty of nations, the United States and others, subverts individual sovereignty. That's what globalism is all about. And that's really the religion these people worship. They worship eugenics. They want to reduce population. And the political mechanism to do that, to a large degree, is globalism, to tear down international, to tear down any boundaries between countries. That's why we have the EU, the European Union. That's the model, and that's why we have the burgeoning North American Union, modeled after the EU. To quote Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, which was referred to in that NATO article, quote, nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations until the Security Council has taken measures necessary to maintain international peace and security. Measures taken by members in the exercise of this right of self-defense shall be immediately reported to the Security Council and shall not in any way affect the authority and responsibility of the Security Council under the present charter to take at any time such action as it deems necessary in order to maintain or restore international peace and security. And if you haven't noticed, the world is not a safer place at all due to NATO, whenever the UN has intervened. It's never made any situation that I can recall better. So this situation with Turkey, okay, Russia didn't attack Turkey. Turkey, a NATO member, attacked Russia. So you could say if if you're at the top of the pyramid here, the power structure, and you want to provoke World War III, what's one way to do it? Well, just start to be provocative against Russia. Have a NATO nation shoot down a Russian jet. If the Russians respond, then they invoke that. They invoke that article and just say, well, an attack on one nation, on one NATO nation, attack on all. And the thing that is really, there's a lot of things that are disturbing about. Number one, it subverts the sovereignty of the United States. It subverts the sovereignty of the United States. The United States should only go to war based upon what is good for the United States. And that doesn't mean there aren't agreements with other countries. But when those agreements subvert our sovereignty and put U.S. security at risk, they become self-defeating. But again, realize the goal has always been this idea. It's always been the one world government. What's the route to one world government? To a global government. The route or the path to global government is regional government. Again, look at the EU. I've read that over 70% of the laws that affect people in Great Britain aren't made in Great Britain. They're made in the European Union. Bureaucracy. Okay, they take the power from the sovereign nation, subvert it, set up these regional government structures. You see it in the U.S. in a lot of ways, particularly with the EPA, the so-called Environmental Protection Agency, will enforce regulations that are really mandates that are given at the international level. That's why, for example, it's not just Obama, but he's in power now. That's why he's shutting down clean coal-burning power plants. They're going to create artificial scarcity. They shut down coal power plants based upon these international mandates. It has nothing to do with the environment. It never has. So, and it is funny, too, incidentally, I won't go in that direction now, but how many you have all these Republicans, you know, running for president, and no one that I've heard of yet has yet to say if he's elected, they'll abolish the EPA. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, was written into existence by an executive order of President Richard Nixon. It could go away by an executive order, but they obviously, just like the United Nations, they don't want it to go away. Both parties pursue that policy. They're committed to basically bringing down the economy slowly through so-called environmental measures, which has nothing to do with the environment or carbon-based life form. It's the same thing with the United Nations. In spite of the fact the United Nations exist to subvert U.S. sovereignty, doesn't matter who's in office, Democrats or Republicans in Congress or the White House, no one withdraws from the U.N., which would be the irrational thing to do if you believe in the sovereignty of the U.S. Speaking of which, there was a very interesting exchange on Capitol Hill. Defense Secretary Panetta with Jeff Sessions. This was in 2012. Okay, and Secretary Panetta, okay, under Obama, said that the U.S. military was not under control of the U.S. Senate, but was under control of either NATO or the UN. And this is one of the few times again you hear sometimes out of Washington you actually hear something that is important. It isn't just it's not just meaningless banter.
General Dempsey, you in one of your criteria for determining what we might do militarily, you have to ask the question whether the action is worth the cost and is consistent with law. What law does the United States military look to?
Yeah, if I could, since I'd like to address both because they are related. So cost, resources, use of force one other place. So, you know, it's a zero-sum game. We take them from someplace else, we use them for how long, and that's the kind of issue of cost. Is it? And, of course, in blood and treasure. The issue of legal basis is important, though. We act with the authorized use of military force either at the consent of a government, so we're invited in, or out of national self-defense, there's a very clear criteria for that. And then the last one is with some kind of international legal basis, an UNSCR.
Wait a minute. Let's talk about an international legal basis. You answer under the Constitution to the United States government, do you not? And you don't need any international support before you would carry out a military operation authorized by the commander.
No, of course not. That's the second
one I meant. I just want to know that because there's a lot of references in here to international matters before we make a decision. And I want to be sure that the United States military understands, and I know you do, that we're not dependent on a NATO resolution or a UN resolution to execute policies consistent with the national security of the United States.
So,
now, Secretary Pinella, you, in your talk, in your remarks, you talk about We're working to increase diplomatic isolation and encouraging other countries to join the European Union and Arab League in imposing sanctions. And then you note that China and Russia have repeatedly blocked the UN Security Council from taking action. Are you saying, and is the president taking the position, he would not act if it was in our interest to do so, if the U.N. Security Council did not agree?
Senator, when it comes to our national defense, we act based on protecting the security of this country, and we don't look for permission from anybody else when it comes to our national defense.
Good.
When it comes to the kind of military action where we want to build a coalition and work with our international partners, then obviously we would like to have some kind of legal basis on which to do it as we did in Libya.
Now, some sort of legal basis. We worried about international legal basis, but nobody worried about the fundamental constitutional legal basis that this Congress has over war. We were not asked stunningly in direct violation of the War Powers Act whether or not you believe it's constitution. It certainly didn't comply with it. We spent our time worrying about the UN, the Arab League, NATO, and too little time, in my opinion, worrying about the elected representatives of the United States. As you go forward, will you consult with the United States Congress, and can we be assured that you will have more consultation and more participation and legal authority from the duly elected representatives?
Believe me, we will. We don't, we don't have a corner on the market with regards to, issues involving our defense. We want to consult with the Congress. We want to get your best advice and your guidance. And when we take action, we want to do it together.
And do you think that you can act without Congress to initiate a no-fly zone in Syria without congressional approval?
Our goal would be to seek international permission, and we would come to the Congress and inform you and determine how best to approach this, whether or not we would want to get permission from the Congress. I think those are issues we would have to discuss as we decide what to do here.
Well, I'm almost breathless about that, because what I heard you say is, we're going to seek international approval, and they will come and tell the Congress what we might do, and we might seek congressional approval.
No, well,
I want to just say to you, that's a big dish. Wouldn't you agree, you've served in the Congress?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you agree that that's would be pretty breathtaking to the average American? So would you like to clarify that?
But I've also served with Republican presidents and Democratic presidents, who has always reserved the right to defend this country if necessary.
But before we do this, you would seek permission of the international authorities.
If we're working with an international coalition and we're working with NATO, we would want to be able to get appropriate permissions in order to be able to do that. That's something that, all of these countries would want to have some kind of legal basis on which to act.
Well, what legal basis are you looking for? What entity?
Well, obviously, if NATO made the decision to go in, that would be one. If we developed an international coalition beyond NATO, then obviously some kind of UN security resolution would.
So you're saying NATO would give you a legal basis And an ad hoc coalition of nations would provide a legal basis?
If we were able to put together a coalition were able to move together, then obviously we would seek whatever legal basis we would need in order to make that justified. I mean, we can't just pull them all together in a combat operation without getting the legal basis on which to act.
Well, who are you asking for the legal basis from?
If it's obviously if the UN passed a security resolution as it did in Libya, we would do that. If NATO came together as we did in Bosnia, we would rely on that. So, we have options here if we want to build the kind of international approach to dealing with the situation.
Well, I'm for all for having an international support, but I'm really baffled by the idea that somehow an international assembly provides a legal basis for the United States military to be deployed in combat. I don't believe it's close to being correct. They provide no legal authority. The only legal authority that's required to deploy the United States military is the Congress and the President and the law and the Constitution.
Let me just for the record be clear again, Senator, so there's no misunderstanding. When it comes to the national defense of this country, the President of the United States has the authority under the Constitution to act to defend this country, and we will. If it comes to an operation where we're trying to build a coalition of nations to work together to go in and operate as we did in Libya or Bosnia, for that matter, Afghanistan, we want to do it with permissions either by NATO or by the international community.
Well, I'm troubled by that. I think that it does weaken the ability of the United States to lead. If we believe something ought to be done, I'd be thinking we would be going more aggressively to NATO and other allies, seeking every ally that we can get. But I do think ultimately you need the legal authority from the United States of America, not from any other extraterritorial group that might assemble. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, if you caught that, there's a lot of mind-blowing things that came out of that exchange in 2012 between Republican Senator Jeff Sessions and then Secretary of Defense Panetta. And one of the things that was mind-blowing was Panetta had said more than once, there's these two levels of legal authority to employ or use U.S. military power. One is if the U.S. is threatened, okay, then he would appear to believe in constitutional powers, allegedly. Again, they didn't even talk about it. Even Senator Sessions didn't even talk about Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. Only Congress can declare a war. And then we have the limited exceptions for specific missions. You could use the letters of marque and reprisal. But apart from that, Panetta then goes in and says, you've got two levels. You got that one level, and you got this other level. Then you start to talk really mystically. And I'm glad Sessions exposed his, to use a philosophical term, his sophistry, which basically means he was making stuff up. And then Panetta said, no, well, if we have an international coalition, then really Congress isn't needed. And then Sessions pressed him more than once, saying, what's this legal basis if you're talking about this type of coalition? So they basically just, Panetta was saying, well, if the U.S. is involved in some type of international thing, and it's funny, Sessions back in 2012 even threw out the example. He says, what about no-fly zone Syria, no-fly zone in Syria, which people, they wanted, which is an act of war. And Panetta wouldn't say, he did say, it really has nothing to do with Congress. If the U.S. is involved in some type of coalition that they could just do it. They could the U.N. and then NATO. Okay, you go back to NATO. When NATO was cut, again, NATO following a few years after the heels, on the heels of the U.N., allegedly NATO comes into existence to counter the Warsaw Pact when you had the Soviet Union controlling Eastern Europe and those Soviet states. You had those satellite states of the Soviet Union at the time. When you had that going on, NATO comes into existence, okay? But from the inception again, they invoked the authority of the UN. So there's a bigger picture. It wasn't just about the security of the members of NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So who was in NATO originally? Okay, how many member nations were there? Okay, right now NATO has 28 members. 28. In 1949, there were 12 founding members. That was Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Okay. In 52, Greece and Turkey were added. Germany was added in 55. Spain in 82. Then look what happens after the Soviet Union falls. 1999, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland were added. Then in 2004, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia were added. And then in 2009, Albania and Croatia. So you look on a map, and it's very clear what's happened. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States, under the guise of NATO, has basically been the aggressor, and they've been surrounding the former Soviet Union. They've basically been surrounding Russia by including all these Eastern European nations into NATO. Because remember that article. Remember Article 5. Okay, the parties agree. This is from NATO. NATO's founding principles. Article 5. The parties agree that an armed attack against one or more of them in Europe or North America shall be considered an attack against them all, and consequently they agree that if such an armed attack occurs, each of them exercises the right of individual collective self-defense recognized by Article 51 of the Charter of the UN will assist the party or parties so attacked by taking force with individually in concert with other parties such actions as deemed necessary, including the use of armed force. So the way it was written initially, it was just talking about Europe or North America. So it'd be interesting, though, Turkey is a NATO ally, a NATO member state. What would happen if Russia did attack Turkey? Because you look at that charter, now I see it. It's just talking about Europe and North America. Turkey is not in, they're definitely not North America. To the best of my knowledge, it's not in Europe. But you go back to what that exchange between Sessions and Panetta. Okay, that was one of the mind-blowing things that Panetta said. There's two levels of legal authority for the U.S. military to operate: defense of the U.S. and then this international stuff. And then when he was pressed, Panetta was openly said it really didn't need the authority of Congress to act internationally. So even to do something like a no-fly zone in Syria, which would be considered an act of war, he basically said, no, if the U.N. or NATO says if the U.N. or NATO basically wants the U.S. to do it, they'll do it. Okay, and that tells you how far gone we are from what was once a constitutional republic. Okay, got one more clip tonight, and that's Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio is, in my opinion, the new establishment pick for Republican candidate for president because they know Jeb Bush, it seems, isn't going to come back. So Rubio is the same form, fit, and function as Jeb Bush, different face, and he's younger, Latino. Jeb Bush is married to a Latino, but Rubio himself is Latino. So here you have Rubio talking about this, and he basically says the U.S. should be willing to go to war with Russia over Turkey. Okay. This is a man who's, I think, the current establishment pick running for president.
Senator Marco Rubio is our guest today. Senator, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Just a reminder for our viewers, we like to get through four questions. Hopefully we get through a lot more, but this is purely their questions that we like to ask you, put them in a little context, mm-hmm. bring in some breaking news, and we have ourselves usually a really fun time. So I'm going to start off with the news of the day. Turkey has shot down a Russian jet. We know Turkey is a member of NATO, and there's a lot of statements coming out really within the last 10 minutes from all sides about what should be done. Rudy, one of our viewers, says this: is Turkey still an ally to Senator Marco Rubio? How would President Rubio handle what happened overnight?
Well, first, Turkey is a member of the NATO alliance, and so if the NATO alliance is to remain vibrant, then we have to live up to our commitments in that alliance. We can't decide that we're not going to work on behalf of one of these countries. Do we have concern about things happening in Turkey? I absolutely do. Erdogan has taken that country in a more, I would say, a little bit more radical direction. They've broken from a longstanding good relationship with Israel. You've seen him kowtow to some of the more Islamist elements of their political parties in the country. So there is deep concerns about what's happening internally within Turkey. And quite frankly, a little bit of lack of cooperation on their part in the fight against ISIS up until very recently. That said, they are still a member of the NATO alliance, and if we were not to come to Turkey's defense and assistance in any instance, it would undermine the NATO alliance. And so that's something we need to understand.
What would that
NATO
look like?
NATO is important today as it's been in 20 years.
For example,
Russia's saying
today, you know, this is an unfriendly act, this is a stab in the back. If Russia actually takes measures, and we don't know what those are, against Turkey, what does the United States do?
Well, first, it's the reason why I warned about having Russia in the Middle East is so complicated. I warned exactly specifically this could happen, that there could be an incident with Turkey, a NATO ally, that they could have that they could aggressively fly over their territory and be shot down. They do this to the Baltic states, and obviously they did it in this case when it comes to Turkey. So what would a confrontation look like? Well, first of all, you already seen it, and that is, what will the Russian response be? And this is a critical moment, because if Russia believes that they can respond and retaliate against Turkey because NATO's not going to do anything about it, what they are basically doing is they are making the argument that NATO is no longer viable, that it is a feckless alliance. And so it's important for us to be very clear that we will respond and defend Turkey if they come under assault from the Russians. Otherwise, the entire NATO alliance comes into question.
You know, it's interesting. Dan has a question just came up on our chat about that. He says, if that's the case and we're forced to defend Turkey, then you have Russia and Syria and Iran on one side. Is that a formula for war?
Well, we would hope it wouldn't reach that point. My sense is that if, in fact, we were true to our word on and showed that we were going to be supportive of Turkey in this engagement, my sense is that the Russians would not test it. They do not have the capabilities to confront the NATO alliance, particularly the United States or even the Turks for this matter. And so I don't think Russia, you know, at the end of the day, although Vladimir Putin is a gangster and a criminal, he is also a geopolitical actor who makes decisions on a cost-benefit analysis. And he'll have to do something to save face. But ultimately, he is not going to test the alliance if he believes the alliance is going to stand up to him, because he'll lose in that confrontation, and that would be an even bigger setback for him.
All right, so we'll wait and take a pause at this moment, see which all sides do, and then, of course, what place the United States is.
Okay, so Rubio there, like former Defense Secretary Panetta, cares a lot. They care a lot about this NATO alliance. They care a lot about the NATO articles. Notice how he said absolutely nothing about the U.S. Constitution, absolutely nothing. You'd like to think someone who's running for president would be more committed to understanding the simple and original intent of the U.S. Constitution, particularly Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, only Congress can declare war. But no, he's concerned about NATO. And one of the other things he said that was outrageously false there, he said Russia couldn't even deal with Turkey. I believe he's terribly wrong there militarily. But here you have Turkey commits an act of aggression against Russia, and then they threaten to call in NATO if Russia responds, even though Turkey is not in North America or technically Europe. So what do we learn from all this? Number one, the U.S. has categorically lied. The policy of the United States in the Middle East has been based upon a series of colossal lies. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The U.S. invasion of Iraq has been horrifically bad for the people of Iraq, and it has made the U.S. more secure. The U.S. bombing and deposing of Muammar Gaddafi has not made life better for the people of Libya, and the U.S. has not been more secure. And I did not touch upon tonight Benghazi. A good part of what happened in Benghazi is that Benghazi was being used to ship weapons. The U.S. was shipping weapons from Benghazi to ISIS via Turkey. Didn't even get into that tonight. The U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East has been immoral. It's been immoral. It has not helped the people of the Middle East. Any type of assertion that the U.S. policy is humane or is for humanitarian purposes in the Middle East is beyond erroneous. It's an outrageous lie. And that's seen very clearly now in Syria. When the U.S., without reason, says Assad has to go, the U.S. lies, the U.S. government lies and says they're against ISIS when they're not. And Russia is actually destroying ISIS. And that's what creates between Russia and Turkey. One of the greatest examples of why how the U.S. is not committed to getting rid of ISIS is shown in the fact that it took them 15 months to start to destroy the oil trucks and the tankers that ISIS is using to fund their operation to a large degree. Russia didn't wait. Russia went right in because Russia is seriously fighting ISIS, and the U.S. is involved in a show war against ISIS. Yet still, we have Senator McCain, as well as Democrats, saying they want to support this mythical moderate opposition against Assad. Right, right. If Assad's deposed, who's going to gain power? ISIS. ISIS. No. Finally, we see the constitutional basis. NATO was flawed from day one, in my opinion. Should have never been. It was just about countering potential aggression against the former Soviet Union. Should have had no ties to the United Nations. So the NATO articles were critically flawed. NATO should have ceased to exist if the U.S. policy was moral and rational after the former Soviet Union fell, but it didn't. Instead, the U.S. has become more aggressive, using NATO as a tool to surround the former Soviet Union. And didn't have time tonight to talk about Ukraine, but right now, tensions are far higher with Russia than it ever was during the Cold War. Why? During the Cold War, the line of demarcation was between East and West Germany. Right now, it's right at the doorstep of Ukraine. It's right at the doorstep. The U.S. basically caused that, to a large degree, financed and undermined the legitimate government of Ukraine to put in a more pro-Western government. And that's very serious. So I hope you did enjoy the show tonight. Do not let people in Washington, Republican, Democrats, or others lie to you. Learn a little bit about the Constitution, the highest law of the land. Learn a little bit about history. And I hope you defend this country and do what's right according to the highest law of the land and not according to any mythical. Don't believe U.S. policy should be dictated by any mythical or imaginary international authority, which should never subvert or undermine the U.S. Constitution. Next week, Poggi will be back. And I thank him again for the opportunity to host the show.
KIRP Radio!